there's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is September the 26th. It is a Thursday. That means it is time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. I'll actually be cutting two of these today. I'll be doing next week as well. The expert counsel has depiked and have overwhelmed me with content, so I have enough to do two shows. And that means that next week, while there'll be lots of rewinds in it, you'll basically have a Rewind Monday, a Live with me and John on Tuesday, a Rewind Wednesday, a new expert counsel show that I'll be cutting today on Thursday, and then a Friday flashback. So even though next week we'll have some absentees, because I do have to get up to Camden and get everything ready before I leave, you will have some brand new shows next week. In fact, two of them. So I was able to work that out yesterday as I was putting everything together and looking at how much content I had from the council. Well, what about today? What are we going to talk about today? Well, Chris Rossini and Dr. Ron Paul and the Ron Paul Liberty reports will be talking about the escalation of the war in Israel and how that impacts us. And I think there's some real concern here, and I'll have some expansion on that. Annie McCann will talk about dealing with cramping of muscles on carnivore. And I think he has three great recommendations, but I'm going to tell you that I think the number one recommendation is salt and hydration. And I'm going to talk a little bit, though, about the obsession people have with Himalayan pink salt and how it's not magic. And it's not bad. It's just not magic in what we need to understand about all the other minerals, because it's still mostly sodium chloride. Anyway, we're also going to talk with Sean Mills about choosing insulation for an attic and spray foam, when it's the right choice and what not to do if you're going to go that way. Joel Riles will talk about a dog that's being aggressive toward their own handler. This can be a dangerous situation, so Joel will tell you to proceed at your own risk with some of the things he's going to talk about. Michael Melito will talk about the ins and outs of copper bullets. That's actually a great topic we've never covered. Nicole Sauce will talk about storing potatoes and preventing them from like rotting and not actually staying in storage. I have a little addition to that one. Jean Pugliano will talk about when you still want to save more money, but you maxed out that 401k because of your earnings and how much you can contribute and some back doors you can use to keep saving money in a tax-deferred status, at least some of it. And I have an anchor segment for you that is, Jack was right, and another one of these situations where the overall macro trend of it is one of those places where maybe it'd be better if I wasn't. While I do want to see a complete correction to the nonsense of every child go to college, there is a larger macro in the economic sense of what's going on here. What if I told you? What if I told you? In the last two academic years, almost 100 colleges net loss. So there's, yeah, they make new colleges all the time. They made like 60 of them. But the overall net loss is going to be 100 colleges over the last 2 years. And we haven't hit the enrollment cliff yet. I'm going to talk a little bit more about exactly what the enrollment cliff is, why it's actually coming in the next college enrollment period, why all the colleges are shitting their pants about it, what it means for so many small towns across America that literally exist around one of these small colleges. It's like a smaller version of when military bases close. And how this impact is only going to accelerate over the next 5 years. Because the bodies are just not there to fill the seats. And I'm going to tell you some of the things, 10 strategies to overcome the enrollment cliff put out by VitalDesign.com, one of the organizations these people really listen to is Vital. And how like none of the actual solutions actually are solutions to the real problem. It's all marketing bullshit. And what this means for us, as I keep saying, we are in an unraveling. We're in an unraveling right now. You're looking at it. Everybody's waiting for the big crash. You're in it. This is the black hole on Star Trek where you think that like you're looking at the other people in distress and they're way down in there, and it's actually you. And it's all happening in such a drawn-out slow-motion speed that you don't understand the disaster unfolding around you. So we'll talk about that in my anchor segment today. With that, let's go ahead and jump right on into it and hear from Chris Rossini and Dr. Ron Paul.
You know, if I were in Congress, thank goodness I'm not, I would demand some answers. What is their mission? You, Mr. President, are sending U.S. troops into a combat zone. After, remember, Kamala said, we don't have any troops in a combat zone. They're sending them into a combat zone. What is their mission? What are they allowed to do? What are they supposed to do? And I think Americans looking at this and looking at the war, which has escalated significantly, the Israelis killed about 500, more than 500 Lebanese in one single day. So that's a big escalation in the war. Americans should be wondering, what happens if these things goes even more south? What if Iran gets involved? This could expand very much, and you could be looking at things like a military draft. You know, we need to have a lot more people. So Americans are going to start dying over there if we don't start paying attention. Of course, that's exactly what Israel wants. They want us to fight this war because they know that they've picked a fight with everyone around them. Kind of a dumb thing to do, but they're going to need us to fight it. But I would just echo what you said, Dr. Paul. The problem is in D.C., not Tel Aviv. You know, the problem is that we're sending the money, we're sending the weapons, and what do we do? And Dave DeCamp makes a good point in his piece that you referenced. He said, throughout the past year, the U.S. has sent additional forces to the Middle East as a show of support for Israel. The strong support from the U.S., including a constant flow of weapons shipments, has emboldened Israel to escalate in Lebanon and elsewhere in the region. And he put it very well, because it emboldens them. They have the sense that we can do whatever we want because America's got our backs. We can pick fights with whoever we want. We can bomb whoever we want because America stands behind us. And that's the opposite signal we should be sending.
One of the things, Secretary Austin expressed his support for to justify all this stuff. Israel's right to defend itself.
Yeah.
Certainly they have a right to defend itself.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean you have a right to do anything you want anytime and use our money and our troops now.
And I think the world knows that these are U.S. F-35s and F-15s. They're dropping U.S. bombs on Lebanon. And so how does that help our own national security? It just creates new enemies for us that is not helpful at all to us economically, in terms of safety, national security.
All of this actually concerns me a great deal over creating a broad regional war and potentially even what you might call a world war, more so than Ukraine. And I'll give you a few reasons why. First of all, the United States is completely irrational in how we deal with conflict involving Israel. We literally treat Israel like the 51st state. And this always stirs up emotions and people start shrieking on both sides. I don't care if you like what I just said. It is the truth. We act like Israel is like attached to Florida or something. I mean, really. We put so much... In fact, I would say that might even be better, because that would mean at least we really take care of our own, because we don't. We actually give Israel priority over, let's say, Florida or Texas or Pennsylvania or Maryland. Okay? Like, we'll put more effort into helping Israel than helping our own people. And that means that we clearly have the predisposition to get into escalated conflicts on behalf of Israel, who, while we are friendly nations, this whole ally, they're our ally. Where's the alliance? Where's the paperwork? Where is the contract that we have that says we have an obligation to defend Israel? And where's the contract that says they have a reciprocal obligation? Oh, you don't have one? That's because it doesn't exist. So we behave irrationally, and that means that Israel has more of the little guy who's going to get his ass kicked in a bar, but he walks into the bar with like four giant biker goons behind him who he knows will solve any problem he starts. So he'll start conflicts when otherwise he would not, or he will continue conflicts that he would seek to de-escalate because he's got his goons with him. And we're the goons, in case you haven't figured. So that already emboldens Israel. Number two, what do you expect out of Hamas at this point? Do you expect them to surrender? Look at what they've had done to them. So you have what you're heading for here, the best case Israel's going to get out of this, is what you call a Pyrrhic victory. That means that you might win, but the loss exceeds the value of what's gained. Right, and this should be America's strategic defense initiative. Should actually be ensure that anybody attacking this country's best case scenario is a Pyrrhic victory. Instead, no, we back people who are going into the attempt at a Pyrrhic victory. The way you, if you're a gamer, like especially old role playing games with dice and shit, the way I would explain a Pyrrhic victory is you make sure that for every value won gained, there's 10 lost. Right, like yeah, you can attack and you can defeat this thing, but it's going to cost you 10 times what you've gained by the victory. And that's the situation Israel's willingly going into. They mentioned Lebanon. The Israeli troops are actively attacking a foreign country. But see, on October 7th, no, stop it. Stop it. They are conducting active military operations in a foreign country who did not attack. They're giving shelter to Hezbollah. I understand that. I'm still telling you what happened. And then you got Iran in the mix. You've got an area of the world where people have had conflicts and wanted to kill each other for thousands upon thousands upon thousands of years, where borders have shifted around. We fucked with borders constantly and moved them wherever we wanted them, and we think that we can solve a problem that's thousands of years in the making, and we can't. Our arrogance will get us into trouble. It's also incredibly strategic globally. The Russians are deeply involved with the Middle East because they care about having open access to shipping channels. That's always been the case with Russia. Access to the Black Sea and access out to the greater trade networks. This is fucking with shit that bluntly we should leave alone. And this is the problem. If any of you are struggling with this right now, well, what do we do? We should have one answer to this problem, and it shouldn't matter if it's Israel or Costa Rica or Ukraine or Japan. The United States does not have any business sticking its nose into other nations' conflicts, period. It doesn't change because you name the country, you pick a different country. If we took that approach, life would be so much simpler, because here's how I feel about it in general. The day that you can walk through major cities in the United States and not see homeless people strung out and shitting in the streets with needles in their arms. The day that our borders are actually secure from invasion from people coming from other parts of the world that don't belong here, that don't come through the front door the way that any nation needs to run its immigration, right? When that's all gone, when our veterans are not homeless, our wounded veterans are actually given the care that they're entitled to, in my opinion, after their service. When we fix the majority of our problems, then maybe we can turn our face to the rest of the world and tell them what they should be doing. As long as we are the wealthiest nation that's ever existed, and yet we have homeless people shitting in the street, we have homeless people strung out on drugs, we can't secure our own borders, we have an economy in free fall, a clusterfuck. We are inhabited by a bunch of people in their 20s and 30s that you can best describe, at least half of them, as educated idiots. Right? As long as we have all these problems, we just don't have any business telling the rest of the world what to do. I know that sounds crazy. Some of you are going to now send me very angry emails, which I won't read and delete, but you have every right to do that. Let's go on and talk about carnivore diet and cramping with Andy McCann.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann coming to you from CrossFit Garage out here in Woodstock, Georgia. And I got a question here from Kevin in Oklahoma, and it's going to Dr. Ken Berry and myself. I'm curious to see how our answers are similar or different, if he answers this one as well. Anyway, the basic question is, how do I overcome cramping in my calves while maintaining the proper human diet carnivore? The details. After having dabbled with it for several months and experiencing positive change, I have finally switched over to an exclusive eating of a very strict carnivore diet on May 31st. I feel great. It's simple. I don't have energy or mood swings, and I've slimmed down effortlessly. That's easier for someone else to say. My doctor said I was a unicorn when I went for my physical routine. I am 49 years old. I am looking great. All of that convinces me that continuing down this lifestyle is the right decision. I have run into an obstacle, however, now that the weather here in Oklahoma has gotten hot, capitalized, so super hot, I work outside, and according to my Fitbit, I routinely surpassed 25,000 steps on the daily basis. Last week, it caught up to me on one of my routine morning runs when I experienced significant cramping in my calves. I've had a few more since then, and my feet cramped up while I was swimming with the family yesterday. Ouch! What do you recommend? All right, I'm going to take a shotgun approach to this. What I would probably do is all of these, just because that's what I do. But in reality, if you want to figure out which one does the trick, do one at a time and just take notes. So I'll go through them slowly. But let me just tell you them real quick, and then I'll go through each of them. So stretch and roll, get the right supplements, hydration, repetitive tasks, your shoes, and then lemongrass oil. Okay, so stretch and roll. get a foam roller and start rolling out your calves. You can go Google or YouTube how to roll out your calves, but it's pretty easy. You just, you know, sit down and then roll your calves back and forth. If you really want to be like painful or intentional on this, get somebody else to press down on your calves and roll them back and forth, and you can slide them up and down, and you're going to feel some super love. It's actually going to hurt quite a bit. Doing it yourself isn't bad. Having someone else even put the slightest pressure on it is going to put in some extreme pain. And I would do this until it stopped hurting. Not all at one go, but over the months. For example, when you do this sort of rolling on like your IT band, it's going to hurt for a long time. It takes about 3 months for it to finally stop hurting. But if it hurts, that means you probably should be rolling that, right? So stretch and roll. And I'll put a link over to Jack that he can add in there for a roller on Amazon. So I think this particular roller has got, let's see, I think it was 100,000. No, that's some dumbbells. Let's see. Yeah, this roller's got 108,000 purchases with a 4.6 star rating, and it's actually the one we use at our gym, so it's going to be a good one for you. So stretch and roll. The other kind of stretching you could do is put your foot up on a wall and then lean into it. Now, you can lean in a different way, so you can push your knee in, you can push your hip in, you can push your chest in, and it's going to kind of pull in a different area. You can also get a, like, cut a 2x4 in about a foot section, put about a 45 degree against the wall, or you can make the angle more or less, whatever you want, and then use that to keep your toe from bending up. It's going to give you yet another different stretch. So you can try these different things and see if stretching and rolling is the ticket. Now, the thing that you said that really kind of, like, keyed off of me is, hey, I'm doing all this stuff, sounds like you get a lot of reps, and then it turned hot. So I would say it's probably not the stretching and rolling. It's probably a mixture of the hydration and, you know, minerals. So take a look at, especially when you're like not eating a lot of different things, if you're really going down the carnivore road, your body may be missing some stuff. So take a look at magnesium, potassium, electrolytes, and salts. I think, well, let me go find a link for it. I couldn't find this with the in Amazon, but I did find it on their website, Hammer Nutrition, and it's called Endurolytes. It's just an electrolyte replacement pill. I use it when I do races with my daughter, so the adventure racing type stuff. But I would, you know, start checking that out too. The other is hydration. Are you drinking enough? If you're doing that much running and it's that hot, you may need just simply to increase your hydration. Now, it is possible if you drink too much Gatorade, you actually mess up your body's chemistry, so don't drink a bunch of Gatorade. Actually, you probably shouldn't be drinking Gatorade if you're doing a carnivore diet, because we wouldn't be eating sugar, right? But if you're drinking a lot of water, you can actually drink weirdly. You can drink too much water and mess things up too. So if you're going to get like a salt, I would probably go with some sort of Himalayan salt, and then you can put it underneath your tongue and let it dissolve. Let me see if I can find a link there too. I did find this one, and it is what I use at home. So here's the Himalayan pink salt, and we take a couple crystals, and I put it under the tongue and let it dissolve, and then drink it down with some water. So I'll put a link, and Jack can throw it up there. But this is on Amazon as well. The other things that I would look at is repetitive tasks. So are you doing too much of the same thing? Sounds like you're out. I mean, 25,000 steps is a lot. Good for you. But if you're out there running and then doing all this other stuff, is it like, you know, too much? Or did you recently add in, hey, I'm starting to do jump rope, or I'm doing a different type of walk, where I'm walking up bigger hills or smaller, whatever, right? So did something change? I would look at that change and say, hey, let me normalize that a bit, or go slowly into whatever I'm doing. I've got some people at the gym that want to practice their jump rope, and so they do it every day, and they get leg cramps, and so we routinely roll out. The other one is your shoes. Maybe you're in old shoes, or maybe you bought new shoes that aren't the right shoes, so take a peek at those. You can also get different inserts into the soles to help out, but doing a lot of walking on bad shoes could be a bad thing. I like, I'll link it to it as well. I like these Innovate shoes. They're very low profile. It's weird. There's not much to them, and so they cost more. All right, so now we're going to have several links for you guys. Jack, hope that's okay. Anyway, the last thing, and it's kind of a weird one, is lemongrass oil, so essential oil. So if you're in, have somebody around you that's into that doTERRA or whatever the other one is called, ask them for some lemongrass oil and put it underneath, like in the bottom of your feet. Weirdly, sometimes that works. That's kind of like the old Eye of Newt in Witch's Brew, but I've seen it do the trick, so that could be a thing. So those are the things that I would start with. Me, I would do all of them and just hope they went away and then start backing them out. But really what you should do is one at a time and see which one actually hits it. I think with the heat and the volume, it's probably simply like the magnesium, potassium, or electrolytes and salts, or amount of hydration. All right, take care.
So as I said in the introduction on this one, I really believe that when people go on a carnivore diet, if they start having cramping, it usually is a lack of hydration and a lack of electrolytes and mineral salts. We have had so much war on sodium in this country, and so people think that they're eating low salt diets, but they don't realize like every single thing you buy in a box is just loaded with salt. So when they tell you not to eat salt, they feed the shit out of salt to you. So I don't even think it needs to be carnivore so much. I think that when people go on like a Whole Foods diet and they stop eating shit that comes in boxes and packages, and when you go carnivore, you always do that. Not every other form of keto do you do that. This is going to be a massive reduction for many people in their intake of salt. And just using any good quality natural salt. So I'm not disagreeing with Andy that, you know, Himalayan pink doesn't fill that niche. But what I'm trying to get across to you is it's not magic. And this idea that you'll get all your minerals if you just use, you know, unprocessed Himalayan salt or Redmond's or whatever. If you look up what that salt is composed of, and I don't care if it's Himalayan or Redmond's or ocean salts or whatever, okay? You will find that they're like 99.2% sodium chloride. And all those other minerals they're talking about make up less than 1%. And in particular with Himalayan sea salt, it's actually a little bit more so. There's other things. It's more like 98.2 or something like that sodium chloride. Oh, yay! There's more minerals. That's why. Well, the number one mineral that you'll find in Himalayan sea salt other than sodium chloride is fluoride. So if you're filtering the fluoride, you see the problem, right? It's natural fluoride. Fluoride is the same molecule. And I'm not saying there's enough in it to really worry about. I'm just saying that other than salt in there, most of the rest is fluoride. I would tell you that, but any good salt, anything that's not refined, anything that is a natural salt would fill this role. And to use as much salt as you find pleasing on your food, and don't worry about using too much, because you won't. Like, there's been research done on this. Humans self-limit salt intake to what they find palatable. And then hydrate. When you go on any kind of ketogenic diet, carnivore being the extreme version thereof, you will generally shed 5 to 10 pounds of weight in the first 2 weeks. That is not all fat. A huge amount of it is water. And so there's an adjustment to that. And the reality is that that's actually a really good thing. It's not being dehydrated. It's the average person is carrying about way too much retained water in their body, and you flush that. But then the body has to adjust to that. So you can't drink too much water. You're not going to die from drinking. I know people have actually caused themselves problems drinking, but it's like, is spiteful intentional proof that I can hurt myself with water? I'm talking about day-to-day drink water whenever you're thirsty or you think you're thirsty. You're not going to overdrink water. And use salt. And I think that will do most of it. And then the other things Andy mentioned, I do have links to the foam roller and to the shoes. And I'm actually going to check into those shoes because that might just be a really good shoe brand. I don't know. Anyway, let's go ahead and hear now from Sean Mills on attic insulation.
Hey, everybody. It's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead. And today I've got a question from Joshua. He says, are there any benefits to putting spray foam insulation directly under roof? Details. My air handler is in my attic space. The joke is making ice cream in the attic. I have read that you can encapsulate the attic space with spray foam under the roof and block airflow. I am sure there are pros and cons. I live in Central Virginia. Our home is small, about 1,000 square feet, so supplies wouldn't be killer. If this is a bad idea, I'd look to add a radiant barrier to block the heat from the roof. Snow load isn't a worry. We get a little snow some years, a little more than others. Thanks, Josh. Well, Joshua, let me cover a couple things. So, generally speaking, it is a good idea to use spray foam to encapsulate an attic. However, there are problems that it can create, and you need to make sure you understand those problems and how to mitigate them before moving forward with this system. I would say, in general, I would not DIY spray foam insulation. If you don't get the mix right, if you don't spray properly, you can create all kinds of issues. My experience here is I actually started up a spray foam company under the umbrella of my old company back in 2013 that grew to a $22 million endeavor, covered the entire southeastern United States, and I have literally had the gun in my hand doing spray foam. So with all that being said, I would not redo another spray foam job myself. I would always hire an expert. So let's talk about some of the problems that you can create. Number one, well, actually, let's talk about some of the benefits. So spray foam, closed cell spray foam insulation, which is what we're talking about, it's going to be moisture barrier, it's going to be a radiant barrier, it's going to provide the insulative effect, and it's actually going to make your roof stronger. So when we think about studs or rafters and the placing for those, like on 16-inch centers, for example. The reason we do that is because we can actually have failures in those systems through either rolling or bending before deflecting, okay? And so they're not going to like bend and break in the dimension that the roof is in. They'll actually start rolling over and then they'll break. So when we add spray foam insulation to those roofs, we actually make them stronger because we essentially create a monolithic structure for the entire roof, which is nice. So I've actually seen places where tornadoes have come through and have torn roofs off in a neighborhood, and the roofs in the neighborhood that were not torn off were part of a spray foam insulated system, whereas the ones that were blown off were your standard fiberglass or blown-in insulation. So it makes your house stronger, and that's a good thing. But one of the problems with encapsulating that attic is that you've got gable vents and you've got soffit vents, right? And they allow airflow through the attic, utilizing the chimney effect, and that actually helps to maintain similar humidity levels and temperature levels from inside and out. And what that does is it prevents condensation from building up on the actual structural members of the house, which are going to lose heat faster. And obviously that's helpful because you don't want mold and insect infestation in your attic. But when you encapsulate the attic and you close off those vents, well, now you've made an airtight structure. And so that can cause some problems that you should be aware of. One of those is you might find that you've got way more humidity in the house than you did before. And you might say, well, why is that? You know, why does that happen? Well, your HVAC system for the size house you have is probably about a 2-ton, I'm guessing 2 to 2.5 tons. And it is sized for your existing leaky house. You take the leaks out, and now your HVAC system may run half the time, which you might think is great. Less power. This is awesome. The problem is if it's not running long enough to reduce the humidity levels in the house, then you get good temperature, bad humidity. So you might have, 72 degrees in the house, but you might still be at 78% humidity, which is not what you want. So you might have to look at putting in a whole house dehumidifier to deal with this issue. The other thing that you might run into is that the airtight closing of the house may prevent the home from getting enough ventilation. This can cause negative air pressure issues, positive air pressure issues, or it can allow the buildup of VOCs and pollen and dust and other, irritants in the inside air. So you want to think about how do you manage air exchange from the outside to the inside. The way it happens right now is you have, obviously the venting system that I mentioned before in the attic, which will actually end up pulling some air up from the living space into the attic. And what does that do? Creates negative pressure. And that will pull air in from the outside. So if you eliminate that issue, that quote unquote issue, then you eliminate that air being pulled in. So you might want to manage air changes. You can get whole house dehumidifiers that will do this. It's not an uncommon problem. And then the other thing is, you mentioned you have your air handler in your attic. Make sure your furnace is not up there as well. Because if it is, then you need combustion air from the outside in order to prevent CO buildup. Okay, so just make sure that it's just an air handler that's up there and ducting. And if that's the case, then as long as you address those other issues, I think it's a fantastic idea. Like I said, I would hire this job out. I would not DIY it. And I would bring in multiple contractors, and I would quiz them on all these things that I just mentioned. Make sure that they make you feel comfortable that they understand these issues. Make sure that they are licensed and insured. And this is a big deal because an improperly sprayed spray foam attic can cost about 4 times what the initial quote was to tear out a bad system and replace it with a new one. So you want to make sure if these guys come in and they create a problem for you that someone's going to cover getting that problem fixed, whether it's them or their insurance.
The other thing is you need to understand if you're spray foaming, you're going to have to leave the house from somewhere between 1 and 3 days just for that off-gassing to happen. And again, this is another thing. If the mix is not proper and it's not applied the right way, that off-gassing will never stop. It will never fully cure. It will always off-gas, and there's tons of problems that living in a house that's continuously off-gassing can create for you. So I definitely would not DIY this project. I would bring in contractors. I would ask them all these questions, and I would maybe double check with my HVAC guy to make sure that encapsulating the attic isn't going to cause any other problems.
So my biggest takeaway is do not DIY it. If I was doing like a small cabin built on a tough shed and I was doing all the work myself, I would probably risk DIYing spray foam, both in the walls and in the roof, because it's a small, relatively low-cost thing. And because I'm not retrofitting it, I'm doing it from the very beginning, I can really know that I've, and it's only so big, so I've routed everything I need. I could throw some extra conduit in if I need to get some sort of wiring or cabling in later. It's not going to be a problem. I'm going to absolutely take Sean's advice if I were to ever do it to a house, especially a house being retrofit that I'm going to live in, a full-size home, for a variety of reasons. One, you know, my rule with hiring somebody to do a thing is if there's long-term consequences to it being done wrong, and I've never done it before, I hire someone, period. I mean, even if I wanted to learn to do it, then I would hire someone and ask, you know, pay them extra money to show me how. And I wouldn't, this is a one-time thing. You're not going to do this every weekend. So I would absolutely definitely hire someone to do that. The other side of it is, and this is just something you have to always think about when you're dealing with real estate, will what you're going to do adversely affect your ability to sell that property later? Because even if you do it and it looks right, it's just not, and you know, you go up there or a future buyer goes up there and checks it out, goes, oh, it looks pretty cool, it's insulated, it's foam break. Like, if your inspector, there will always be a home inspection, right? If they say this is done improperly, it is a huge problem. It is a huge problem. Mortgage companies will say, well, we're not giving a loan on this till it's fixed, that type of thing. If you have it done by a professional company that's in business, right? Like, not Sam and Dave's, you know, spray truck, right? But a real legitimate company's been around a while. And you end up in that situation, it becomes their problem under their warranty, not yours. And you have recourse. And you also have the ability to say, look, this was put in by a certified installer. And you could actually have a way to contest this inspector's opinion because he may be wrong. And if you have a certified installer and they say, we stand behind this, there is no problem, you may be able to get that taken care of. Where if you're like, I had Sam and Dave and Sam and Dave's spray truck do it, or me and my buddy Bill did it, it's a different scenario. And I just want you to always, not just with this, when you think about like installing a deck, anything like that, you need to find out what will an inspector who comes and looks at this look for if I sell this house. I don't care if you're like, I'm going to die in this house. Shit changes. Part of real estate is always having an exit strategy and knowing what that exit strategy is. And the less things like that to pop up, the cleaner the exit strategy is. Anyway, let's talk about dealing with an aggressive dog. But in this case, you have a dog you're trying to train, and that dog turns toward you with aggression, from Joel Riles.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you with another expert counsel question. Today's question is about dealing with a dog who's being aggressive toward their handler. Now, real quick, right up front, I want to say this can be extremely dangerous. You can get seriously injured trying to deal with these problems. So if you're not comfortable doing some of these drills yourself or dealing with this problem, I would highly recommend you find a local trainer who can work directly with you, and they can also interpret a lot of things that the dogs are doing that you may be misinterpreting and that may be causing some of your problems. Okay, so at your own risk, right? You take this advice at your own risk. However, I've helped a lot of people deal with aggressive dog issues. Obviously, if you're training protection dogs, there's a decent possibility that if you start making the dog do something that it doesn't want to do, and it's also gotten comfortable with doing protection work, it may try to challenge its handler, right? So the very first thing we would do if somebody came to us and they said, hey, I'm having aggressive dog issues, can you help me? The very first thing I do is a couple of private lessons to make sure we're not putting anyone else or their dogs at risk. and I would mostly just make sure that other people and other dogs could move around the dog. The very next thing we would do is we just start working obedience in the dog. So a lot of dogs will get aggressive because the handlers are not communicating well, and they're not the dog is getting to do whatever it wants most of the time, and then the aggression comes when you try to make it do something else and it doesn't want to. And especially once they've tried it once, like they turn and growl or they turn and bite you, and then you back off and they get to do what they want, then in their mind they're like, well, that's a viable option. If my handler tries to make me do something that I don't want to do, growl at them, bark at them, or bite them, and then I'll get to do whatever I want again, right? So we can accidentally train our dogs that that's an appropriate way to act. So by going back into training mode, so by training mode, you have a correction collar of some kind. If you're comfortable using e-collars and you know how to do that, great. We use prong collars typically, although there are some situations where an e-collar would be better for these particular problems. But I just go right back into obedience training. You have a lead and a collar on at all times. You're going to always be in obedience. Now, of course, if your dog has not been doing this, you have to build into it a little bit. And we go over how to do that in Canine Academy in the first couple of modules. But I'm just basically going to say, hey, when I say sit, that means sit. When I say lay down, that means lay down. When I say wait in your place, that means wait in your place. That way, when you actually give a command to your dog, they know, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing, right? So sometimes, in this particular person's example they gave, the dog kind of snuck outside, and he had been kind of aggressive before. He's very territorial over his property, and so the person grabbed his back legs, his hips, to catch him, right, so he wouldn't run into the yard, and pulled him back in the house and got bit in the process, okay? So if my dog is always on a lead, and they have their correction collar on, and they know what we use, the correction word, or verbal correction, is phooey it. It's like German for shame on you, only we throw the it or the that, phooey it, right? But if I tell my dogs, phooey that, they know, ooh, I did something wrong. Right? Well, they learn that by getting corrected when I say seats, phooey it seats, and they get a pop on their lead because they didn't seats. Right? Now, again, I'm not going to go into all the how to do the training that's in the first couple of modules of Canine Academy. You can get the basics, the monthly or the annual if you want to take your dog farther. But just start your basic obedience training again and get those commands strong. When I tell my dog to sit, he sits, whether I'm standing right beside him or whether he's over across the living room, and I just say, hey, Plutz, that's to lay down, and he lays down, right? A lot of times, that takes care of 99% of your issues, because now if you say, phooey that, to the dog, they're like, oh, sorry, boss, and they will immediately come into compliance because they don't want that correction, okay? So that can fix a lot of these problems. If you continue to have problems, and we here at Fortress K9, we say we have a zero tolerance for unwarranted aggression. In other words, if I didn't tell you to go bite that thing or to put your mouth on it, don't put your mouth on it. And if they do, then we have fairly harsh corrections for that, because that's something that can cause injury and hurt people, and it can be the end of the dog's life if that person sues and the dog has to be put down, right? So we want to fix those problems, and we do that by giving the dog a harsh correction when they behave in that manner. If you're not willing to do that, then you either need to find a trainer who can help you, or you might have to find somebody who's willing to deal with the problem, or go ahead and have the dog put down, which I know is sad and we don't want to do. The other thing is, doing these harsh corrections, sometimes the dogs will try to bite you while you're doing the correction. So when you're starting with your obedience, have respect for the dog, but demand respect back. Right? Don't allow the dog to push you around, but don't over push the dog and create issues that otherwise wouldn't have been there, so that you can minimize having an actual, the dog is trying to bite you and now you're having to physically win the fight. Okay? If your dog starts to behave that way, but you can see it kind of coming, but it hasn't happened, that's when an e-collar can be really effective. So when I use e-collars, I put the e-collar on the dog, make sure everything's fully charged up before you do this. Wait 3 or 4 days before you're going to do an exercise where you see the dog might get frustrated or upset or aggressive, and have the e-collar ready to go and do the exercise. And if the dog growls or does anything like that, just step quickly away from the dog and give them the ride. I go 3 to 5 seconds on between 60 and 80% of whatever the max of your e-collar is. Now, you want to make sure before you do this, if your dog has long fur, you want to make sure that that e-collar is still going to be effective, right? So sometimes you have to get longer probes on your e-collar to get through thick dog fur. So you want to make sure it's actually working and doing its thing. So you start off at a low level and slowly bring it up. And in about 20% of your max, you should see the dog kind of start going, whoa, what's that? When you give him a little pop, that's usually not painful. It feels more like if you put it on yourself and you tap your arm, it feels like a tap, right? So you hit it and it feels like they just tapped you right where those probes are. You start getting above that, it actually starts having a painful effect, right? And so for an aggressive problem, though, I want there to be a relatively severe correction. So I'm going to go right to 60 to 80% for that. And then if they do start to show aggression, I'm just going to step away and I'm going to give them a 3 to 5 second ride. And I'm going to be chastising them while they're doing it. And then as soon as it's over, I'm going to be like, relax, buddy. Chill. Everything's fine. And I want to try and let the dog know, as long as you don't do that to me, I won't do anything back to you. But you do that and there's going to be a severe correction. Now, this is, sometimes we start talking about correcting dogs. People can get real squeamish here because I don't want to hurt my dog. Dogs are predators. Predators only understand one thing, and that's force. You can bribe some dogs into doing things with treats and toys, and that's fine for some types of training. But once you get to the point where a dog is acting aggressively, especially toward their own handler, and especially if you've had them more than, say, a couple of months, right? So they know you're their handler, you're their family, you're the person who feeds them, and they're still acting aggressively. And if you want to correct that problem and not just put the dog down, this is the only option. Okay, in my opinion, everything else that I've seen other people try to do, it just simply does not work long term. All right, so the idea here is you want your dog to respect you. So in order to do that, though, you also have to respect your dog. Now, I say respect and not like, because I've seen people attempt to fix this problem by getting down on the ground and sitting with the dog and petting it and blah, blah, blah. That would be like some person that you know that you guys have a pretty good relationship with, all of a sudden just kind of following you around like a lost puppy and begging you to like them more. That's what it is in the dog's perspective when you do that kind of stuff. I pet my dogs a lot, but I pet them when I want to pet them. They don't get to decide when they're going to get petted, right? You want this kind of discipline going forward, especially if you have a fairly dominant male dog, right? Some of your dominant females will be like this a little bit too, but your dominant male dogs are typically where these problems come up, and predators only understand one thing, that's force. You show your teeth to me, you growl at me, you are aggressive in any way, you're going to suffer for that. And as long as you don't do it, then I'm not going to do anything that causes you any pain, other than maybe if we're working, you know, obedience and you're being really stubborn that day, you might get a harder correction, right? But even most of our corrections with a collar, they're not really painful. They're kind of like, hey, I'm serious, pay attention. But they're not, you don't get a yelp out of the dog or anything like that 99% of the time. Every so often it might happen, but very rarely. So again, if you want that help with the obedience, I recommend going and checking out canineacademy.us on the banner on Jack's site at thesurvivalpodcast.com. And if you have more details you want to send in on a specific issue that you're having, I can try and help you out with that. But in general, the dog has to be corrected for being aggressive. Obedience will go a long, long way. If you don't have good, strong obedience in the dog, work that first before you just go straight to correcting the dog. Have respect for the dog, but require respect back. And I'll say it one more time, this type of training can be dangerous. There's a high likelihood you're going to be bitten in the process of training the dog out of this aggression. And any dog bite can have permanent injury to your body, especially your arms and hands. So just be aware of that. Be cautious, but not afraid. And if you're not willing to go through that process, then find a professional dog trainer that can help you. And trust me, it's worth it if they actually know what they're doing. Also, for that particular issue, I would not go to somebody who trains obedience, agility, and that's all they do. I would find somebody who does protection work, who's used to working with dogs that can be aggressive and that bite, and that is knows what stability means. They don't, may not use that word, but a dog that is, I tell you to leave it, and you never challenge your handler. So a trainer like that should be able to help walk you through this if you don't feel like you can do it on your own. All right, guys, I hope that helps. Again, if you're interested in purchasing a dog, a working line Belgian Malinois, German Shepherd, or Dutch Shepherd, you can always find us at fortresscanine.com. We have trained dogs and puppies available. And if you're wanting help with that training itself, check out canineacademy.us and click on the banner over at Jack's website, thesurvivalpodcast.com. Until next time, remember, train hard and stay safe.
So yeah, the last part there is really important. What Joel was talking about is you can't console a dog to correction, I guess is the way to put it. So when that dog's being aggressive, if you are passive, he won. What you're really dealing with in these situations, assuming you haven't really done things the wrong way, or you're not just dealing with a dog that maybe has some problems, you know, this is a totally different scenario. If you got this dog and it was stray and it's 4 years old and you have no idea what its background is. But assuming you've done a basically a good job and that dog is just starting to show aggression towards you, one, the time to correct it is now, instantly, like almost so quickly that it seems like it was preemptive to the dog. But what you're really dealing with now is you have a situation where this dog is saying, well, maybe he's not in charge. This is pack behavior, and I am the dominant one. And one thing I heard Joel say one time when he was talking about dealing with these protection dogs is you want that dog built up with so much confidence as a protection dog that dog's like, I can kill anything except him. And pointing back to the person that's in charge, that motherfucker will kill us all. So he's the one that I am not messing with. And that comes from controlling the dog from youth to the point where the dog never sees itself superior to you. One other thing I wanted to point out, though, and I have no idea really the full background of this story, but I do think it's important to say something here that I think a lot of people lose sight of. Not every time a dog is verbal with you does it always equal aggression. I think you should always side toward it doing it, but there are certain dogs and specifically certain breeds that will, and I have a question in the Joel right now that we'll see if we get it back by the time I'm back from Camden, about a Siberian Husky. And so I have a Husky mix named Lucy, and there are plenty of people who have been here and they say that she is aggressive, right? And what they're saying she's aggressive for is because when she doesn't like something, she's like, brr. She is one of the most beta animals I've ever seen. Now, we tell people leave her alone because a beta dog that just wants to be left be, when you get up in their face, that's when they'll bite you, right? Even the most beta will say, like, I don't want this. I don't like this. Get away. I told you to leave me alone. And it's important to understand that dogs are sending signals all the time, not just verbally. They're sending signals in the way they posture. They're sending signals in the way they hold themselves. They send their signals in the way they hold their head. They send signals in the way that they hold their hair. They literally stand their hair up when they're being aggressive. They send signals that I'm not comfortable, things like the tail being tucked down, right? Like, tail tucked down is I'm a very uncomfortable, I am being submissive, but I'm also very uncomfortable here. And they expect us to understand those signals, right? So just, I'll add that to it. And I will say that, like, aggression has to be corrected immediately and with some level of force. And Joel and I can only say so much about that because, like, some of the things I used to do to keep that, because Charlie was a very aggressive pit mix. And some of the things I did with that dog, and they worked perfectly because I had him since he was 12 pounds and he slept on my chest. And I had the same kind of dynamic, like, I'll kill anything except him. He'll kill us all, right? I could do things like when that dog got aggressive, I would grab him by the neck. I'm telling you, don't do this. I'm telling you, don't do this. I'm telling you, don't do this. This is something that has to be developed over time. And if you don't already know how to do it, you're going to get your arm eaten doing it with a dog like I'm talking about. But I would grab that dog by the neck and I'd put him straight to the ground and hold him down until he submitted. If you go do that to a dog that's never experienced it as a pup that you have not brought up that way, he will eat your arm. So there are techniques, but they are always situational is what I'm getting at. How much time have you spent with the dog before you're initiating this technique? And this is why I'm so big on dogs that are going to be like in this scenario where you're going to expect some level of aggression from them, protecting livestock, whatever. I'm all about adopting older dogs that are well-mannered and what have you. But if you want a dog that's going to be like a homestead dog, starting with a pup really solves a lot of issues because if you have a dog being aggressive, when that dog's 15 pounds and they're wearing a clinch collar, a prong collar, you can just grab the collar and pick them up off the ground, let them hang for a couple seconds, and they'll real quick understand, oh, I got nothing. When you try that with a 75-pound animal that can defend itself and you've never done it before, it doesn't work, right? So I would also advise, following Joel's advice a lot, if this is a real problem, please get professional help. Please get somebody experienced with dealing with this because this is one of those problems we can't really solve on a podcast. We can just give you some ideas about how to look at it. And with that, let's go ahead and hear from Michael Melito on copper. These are copper solid bullets.
Hey, guys. I've been getting a lot of questions on copper, as in copper bullets, monometal, monolithic, they go by many names, as opposed to more classic lead and cup and core type bullets. I want to boil this down into some often asked questions and misunderstandings on copper bullets. First of all, I'm going to leave the condor thing out of it, and I don't think you should be mandated or legislated into using copper. But if you choose to use copper, there are some things that you should know. copper plays by different rules. I'll have to start from scratch, but you got to leave a lot of that behind. Unless they're specifically designed to otherwise, they will have near 100% weight retention. They also, a big difference, is they tend to drive very deep. Deeper than you would think if you were looking at a comparable cup and core bullet. Same caliber and same weight. So even for, let's say, a light for caliber 308, which is a real common deer caliber, where you might not get a solid pass-through with a 150 grain, which is a middle-of-the-road 308 load, traditional hunting bullets, you may very well get a complete pass-through with a solid copper bullet, even if it's a lighter grain weight. And again, unless it's designed otherwise, like there are some fragmenting designs, but in general, near 100% weight retention. Also, kind of throw out what you think about weights. If we stick with the standard vanilla 150 grain 308, which is a good load. I'm not picking on it because it's fat. I'm just using it because it's a really good middle of the road, common loading. A 150 grain all copper bullet is going to be much larger, meaning longer, because it has to be the same diameter. In general, if you want to stay fairly similar for good deer size game, you may look at taking a step back to like 130 something grain. Will give you equal or perhaps even better performance. And you can kind of extrapolate that out, and it's kind of a rough 85% rule. If you were traditionally going to use a 100 grain bullet in a 243, you may look at an 85 grain bullet in the solid copper in the 243, and you would not be really sacrificing any performance. They kind of punch above their weight class, which is one of their big strengths. And since they penetrate so well, it may open up a few more shot angles and things like that that you wouldn't take with a certain load that may open up doors in the solid copper. Because again, they penetrate fairly well. Now, no sponsorship or anything. There's a lot of different companies that make monometal bullets, but the big one, the big solid copper name that has been a big name in the industry for decades, the front runner is the Barnes. TSX and TTSX, the triple shock, the tip triple shock. Those are kind of like the standard, right? Like the Ford F-150 of trucks or the Nike of running shoes. They're not always the best, but they're kind of the standard. Likely, if it's a common caliber, you're going to find either a straight-up Barnes load or like a Federal or other name brand, big brand load that loads Barnes copper bullets. A couple of caveats. If you are hand-loading your own, again, they kind of play by different rules. Don't think if it's a similar shaped bullet, you're going to load it to the same overall length or the same jump to the lands. Reloaders will know what I'm talking about. They are different. You want the same distance from the lands as you would load a traditional cup and core bullet. Also, if it's a factory load, it's mostly for hand loaders, but if it's a factory load and you're, let's say, buying a solid copper bullet for a 270, they're going to load bullets that are going to stabilize in a standard 270. However, if you're hand loading, obviously these bullets are less dense than lead, so they're going to be longer for the same weight. You're riding that ragged edge of like heavy for caliber, don't get that same grain weight in a copper bullet because it's going to be longer. And all we often think about the weight of the bullet as being germane to stabilization, it's really the length. And the copper bullet, the same weight, is going to be longer. But keep that in mind if you hand load. Now, there are also solid copper monolithic bullets for handguns and for defense. I'm generally not a big fan of these because don't be a beta tester in a gunfight. Handguns are limited anyway in their power and their performance for defensive use. One of the things that's really helped out in the last, let's say, 15 years is good modern hollow point technology. There's been a lot of R&D in that in law enforcement, especially law enforcement and FBI testing protocol applications. So there's a lot of good street-proven loads. Pure Gold Dot, Critical Duty, there's a bunch of them, but not as much of that research in the copper bullets. Beware of the copper light for caliber super high velocity game changing ammo. I'm less hip on it for the defensive pistol use, at least for now. Get something that's good street proven load if you're going to trust your life to it. Again, in general, as aforementioned in the preamble, I'm less concerned about condors, but your health and your family's health that's eating this, copper is not a toxin like lead. Now that said, I've been eating wild game since I was metaphorically knee-high to a jackrabbit, grew up on wild game, growing up a poor boy in the South, been a lifelong hunter, been a guide, been a military, law enforcement, range master, firearms instructor for a lot of years, so I'm around a lot of lead. I've had my lead levels tested, and they're fine. But again, if that concerns you, eat a lot of wild game shot with lead, it's certainly going to be less toxic than that. and you're not really giving up performance. They actually perform very well. So just some thoughts on copper. This is real brief. You can get really nerdy real fast on ballistics and copper. I am the host of Gunfighter Life Podcast. Not going to insult your intelligence. You know how to look up and search Gunfighter Life and copper if you want to nerd out on the ballistics. Thanks, Jack, for having me on. Thanks for listening, and have a blessed day.
So I want to give you just one really brief addition to that as to why copper rounds will tend to penetrate better than lead rounds, even at lighter weights. And it is not just because it will expand less, right? If that was the only goal, we could just make a really hard lead. You put enough antimony in lead and you get something really, really hard by creating that alloy. And it doesn't have to be a lot. I mean, in the neighborhood of 5%, and you've got a very low expansion lead round. It is something called sectional density. And because copper weighs less, if you then lead, let's say you have a bullet that's copper jacketed lead and a bullet that's all copper, and let's say the all copper bullet is 150 grains and the copper jacketed lead bullet's 150 grains. If you set them down side by side, the copper one, the solid copper one, having to be the same caliber and roughly the same shape and needing more copper to get the same weight because it's not as dense is going to be longer. And longer is more dart-like. And the more dart-like a round relative to its weight, the higher something called sectional density is. So it is both a hardness issue in the way the round is designed, but it's also the more dart-like shape relative to the weight. So if you have two rounds close in weight and grains, and one's all copper and one's all lead, the all copper one's going to be more dart-like. Just something to know about. one of several reasons that we get that added penetration. Also a big fan of Barnes, and the one he didn't mention, and it's kind of old school, been around forever, trophy bonded bear claw. That's kind of like, if I'm going to go to copper, that's what I'm looking for. And Federal Premium ammunition is exceptional for those of you guys that don't hand load, and they have a huge selection of rounds that include copper rounds from Barnes. Next up, Nicole Sauce is going to help us out with some potato storage.
Howdy, TSP. Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and the Self-Reliance Festival with a question from Evett. Evett asks, how can I store my homegrown potatoes without turning green and growing sprouts? We are getting good at growing food, but not so good at storing and preserving. I've tried to store potatoes in a sack, in a dark cupboard, in a bucket of sand, in cardboard boxes with newspaper. None of these methods kept the potatoes fresh for long. Any information on this topic of storing and preserving would be greatly appreciated. It's not Everett, it's Yvette. I'm sorry, I read that wrong. Anyway, so potatoes are something that, depending where you live in the world, it may be harder to create the environment that you need for longer term storage, but it is possible. So the prevailing advice on the internet is 50 degrees and 90 to 95% humidity. What that means is if you live in a dry, arid area, you need to think about how am I increasing the humidity for potato storage? And really what you're doing is kind of mimicking what they would be like underground without soil contact, because soil contact invites pests and can speed rotting, which is why just leaving them in the ground doesn't always work. Although, where I live in Tennessee, if I leave potatoes in the ground, I get more potatoes next year. So that's also a climate-specific thing. So here's some things about potatoes on just the curing and storage side, and then we'll move on to other ideas. First of all, when you get your potatoes out of the ground, do knock off the clods, but don't rinse them off. I have found in general garlic and potatoes that leaving, like not scrubbing them, really helps them store better. And you could say it's because there's an enzyme on there. I tried to find out the official why and haven't found out the official why. But I do know this. When you wash something, you subject it to damage. And that would be causing a wound on the flesh of the tuber, which can speed rotting. So the first thing you do to cure your potatoes, because they just were ripped out of the ground, which was sad and maybe hurt them a little bit, especially if you hit one with your shovel, wound healing. You do this at 60 to 65 degrees with higher humidity. So you don't plunge them cold right away. You leave them warmer. And that happens for about 3 to 5 days. So that outer, like the skin of the potato, if you will, gets a little bit thicker and cures. And then you want to reduce the temperature slowly, so you don't want to just like plunge them straight into the freezer, obviously, or your fridge from that situation. Dropping below 45 degrees speeds up sugar conversion from the starch that's in them, and this can lead to them degrading faster over time, but actually on the commercial side, because I went to the commercial side to really see, I went separate from like what all the whole old-timey people do. In a commercial setting, they just make sure when they heat them back up, like allow them to get up slowly to temperature rather than putting them out in a like straight up sunny area, right? So in commercial setting, they will store potatoes 45 and below, between 38 degrees and 45 degrees with air movement and high humidity. And that's how they're able to store them long term. I was unable to find if they also remove oxygen, so have them, but they probably do, by the way. I just couldn't find corroboration of that and did not find somebody to call to ask them how they store that. I know they do that with fruit. So anyway, so they're going 38 to 40 degrees for the ones you buy in the grocery store, quote unquote, fresh, that are usually about a year old, and 45 degrees if they're going to be made into potato chips or, you know, french fries or something like that. So if you want to have longer term storage at home, you want to keep the temperature low. And when you're ready to use them, bring them up to temperature slowly and handle the potatoes carefully so they don't get bruised. And then the other thing is at that higher humidity of 90 to 95%, what can happen is water like sticks to the outer skin and like condensates. And if that happens, that can speed up the going bad of the potato. So you want to move air if you can. And then you want to store them in a way that air can move. This is actually why a root cellar works really well for storing potatoes. And that's because, you know, my root cellar is around 55 degrees at the time of year I'm using it. And in a root cellar that's just dug into the ground, you purposely leave soil contact. So you don't just like concrete it in. You let the soil be there. And that's adding humidity to your root cellar. And this creates an environment that sort of mimics the potatoes being underground, but they're not having dirt contact. So that being said, also store in a cardboard box or some way that they're getting some airflow around them. So I use cardboard boxes and maybe three potatoes deep with holes in the sides so that there's airflow. With this, I haven't had a lot of trouble of them not lasting as long as I expect. But my experience in a state or part of the country, of the world, really, where I have higher humidity is I don't struggle with keeping the humidity up so much. In fact, we have the opposite problem. I store potatoes in a root cellar that does not have soil contact. So mine is actually concrete from October to late February. And then about late February, they start growing eyes, like the eyes start putting out sprouts. And that's how I know it's time to start getting ready to plant them, because you plant potatoes in Tennessee in March. And so when I see that happening, I just, you know, get ready to put them back in the ground, because that's part of the cycle of the potato. If I didn't have so much natural humidity in the air, I would think about having an earth contact root cellar. But I do store them in cardboard boxes. I do not circulate the air, and I do inspect the potatoes about every 2 weeks. My official advice is inspect weekly, but what I really get around to is about every 2 weeks. Sometimes I'll go 3 weeks. And what I'm looking for there is any potato that when I touch it, it seems like it's not as firm as it used to be. I'll pull those out for use that week. And anything that looks like it has a bad spot developing, because the thing that'll make your potatoes rot fastest is one goes bad in the very middle, and then it makes everybody else bad in that box very quickly. And then it brings pests in, and that's no fun either. Keep your potatoes away from stored onions, because that can speed up degradation. And as things warm in your area, if your storage area is also warming up, you're going to see them start to put out little rootlets, basically. And you can just cut those off and use the potatoes right away, or you can put them aside for your seed potato for the next year. Finally, variety matters. So red potatoes, like the thin-skinned red potatoes, do not store as long in my root cellar as a like nice, deep, skinny, russet potato. Those last longer. So when I get two kinds of potatoes in my root cellar, I'll use the ones with the thinner skins first, and then I will go into the russet. And then, like, when my fancy varieties start eyeing out early, I just put them aside and let them do that, because they're going to go back in the ground to make more potatoes. This is advice you can adjust to your situation, right? So you know that your core premise is, you know, 45 to 55 degrees, 90 to 95% humidity, and then keeping enough airflow that they don't pool up water, and inspecting them about once a week. If you don't have a root cellar, this means you can find, if you have a basement space, you know, check out how that works temperature-wise. The lower you're getting the temperature, the better. If you want to make a root cellar, you can look at all the creative ways to do that, you know, like by burying a freezer in the ground or something. But I'll say this, local farmers here will put them in their barn under a blanket, and those last for darn near 3 months that way here. So adjust as needed. Find a nice, cool place in your house. It is important also that they are dark. So where, however you store them, put them in a place where they're not getting sunlight or light. So maybe a closet in your house if you have that. Or like if I get potatoes before October, which I do, that I'm storing, then I'm just going to transition into my root cellar. My root cellar is too warm in the height of the summer. And so I put them under my bed because that's the coolest room in the house because I like to sleep cool. So I keep that room cool and that really helps. In the end, the other question I would have is, what's your expectation for fresh storage? Because I'm going 3 to 5 months on mine. Are you trying to store them for a year, or are you trying to store them for longer than that? Or are you only get a month or two? That's all a very different cycle. But I would go back, look at the variety of potatoes you're growing and how long they store, and if they are thicker skinned or thinner skinned, look at how you're curing your potatoes, and then find ways to mimic a low temperature, dark, higher humidity storage solution, but with enough airflow that you're not going to mildew them or do more damage than you were expecting. And then just accept that the cycle, it's like you're riding the cycle, right? When it's their time to eye out, they're going to eye out, and that's how you know it's time to plant them. If you want to extend storage beyond that, your other option is to parboil them and dehydrate them, or to can them, and then you'll have potatoes at those times of year when your potatoes are now growing, but you don't have any in your cold storage. I really hope this helps you address some of the storage issues you have. Guys, don't forget, if you want to learn heritage skills and get to know your tribe in person, we've got an awesome event coming up in Tennessee, October 5th and 6th in Camden at Special Operations Equipment, which means while you're there, you can buy some of the cool t-shirts that Jack and I wear all the time or get other gear because you have access to the store in the factory. You get to see the sewing factory. It's a really cool place to hang out. Jack Spierko is speaking there as well, and I hope to see you. SelfRelianceFestival.com. Make it a great week.
So Molly, real quick addition on that one, and if I missed it, if she said it, I apologize, but I listened to the whole thing while multitasking and I didn't hear her say it, but anything you're storing in root cellar, like a pantry environment, if whatever you're storing it in the box, if you'll line the bottom of that box with a couple inches of biochar before you put your whatever other method you're using, it will do nothing but increase your longevity. It will never reduce it. There's nothing that it will be bad for. There may be some things that you might go to store that it might be somewhat neutral with and not really give you much advantage, but you can always try it. You can always try like two boxes side by side in the same place and see which one works better and if you really gain from the biochar. Biochar can be seen as expensive whether you make your own or not because it is an expensive soil amendment. It takes time and energy to make. Using it that way, I would use it for a season, and then I would go ahead and incorporate it into agricultural purposes anyway. And it's one of the things I keep talking about with biochar is it is not just a soil enhancer. There's about 80 uses for biochar that have nothing to do with directly putting it into soil or compost. Or you might eventually get there. Like this method, we would eventually go ahead and recycle it into the soil. Or if we're using it as a feed additive with let's say, chickens or ducks to increase their feed efficiency, it still ends up in the soil when they poop. Or it ends up in the compost when their bedding gets composted. But there's a lot of ways to actually enhance things with biochar beyond just making the soil better. On that note, I just looked it up. And yes, you can find some information about it specifically aiding in potato storage. But there's also this litany of articles about it. It's all from one study, but it's like it looks like there's 10 studies, but it's really one, that potatoes and biochar are not friends. That it doesn't enhance the growth of potatoes. It actually reduces yield, blah, blah, blah. And when you read it, it's like every other story I've read like that on biochar. It is always that they use naked char, and they do not inoculate it, and they do not treat it properly, and they have no idea what they've really done, and they've gone and they're doing it in sterile environments without a lot of biology. So, anyway, just an aside there. Next up, let's talk about saving for your retirement when you're a high net worth individual, high income, but you max out what the government says you're allowed to keep out of their grubby little hands with tax deferrals like 401ks or IRAs.
Hello, TSP. Well, today we have a really good investing question from Stephen. His overall question is, when do you stop contributing to a standard IRA and just use a taxable brokerage account with high income earnings? Just a little background about his question. He's currently maxing out his employer 401k Roth. And here's his problem, though. Because he's a high income earner, he makes too much money to contribute to his own personal Roth account. And he also mentions that he can't do a backdoor Roth contribution because of the issue of having to prorate taxes. Now, again, this is one of these issues that I'm just going to touch at a real high level. What Stephen's talking about is the convoluted nature that surrounds our retirement accounts. So, for example, if you're filing your taxes as a single individual, you can only make the maximum Roth contribution if your income is less than $146,000. Now, on the other hand, the traditional IRA also has the same income limit, but it doesn't prevent contributions if you make too much. What it doesn't allow you to do is take tax deductions of those contributions. Now, the reason this backdoor Roth contribution works and you're not double taxed is because if you're making the contribution as a high income earner into your IRA, you're not receiving a tax deduction for it. So immediately when you do the Roth conversion, you would normally be required to pay taxes on that contribution because you received a deduction for it. But in this case, since you earn too much to earn the deduction, you can convert it to the Roth tax-free because you never got a tax break to begin with. I know it's convoluted, but think through that. In any case, Stephen rightly points out that he can't do it because taxes on Roth conversions are prorated, meaning that really the only time they're advantageous is if you have a zero or a near zero balance in your IRA. And the reason for that is, let's say you had $100,000 in your IRA, you contributed $7,000 this year as a high income earner and can't deduct that contribution, and then you immediately take $7,000 and Roth convert it. Well, the IRS is going to end up taxing probably 99% of that $7,000 contribution, because they're prorating the fact that you already had $100,000 in that IRA that's subject to taxes, even though the newly put in $7,000 isn't subject to taxes. It's kind of like a first-in, first-out type tax basis in any case. So, Stephen, again, there's workarounds for this. Most likely, your employer allows you to roll over IRAs into the employer-sponsored 401k. And if they allow that, then you can simply take your personal IRA account that you have and, without paying any taxes on it, roll it into your employer's traditional 401k. Now you have a zero balance in your IRA, and you can take the backdoor Roth contribution. Okay, that's one way to do it. An even better way is that if you have self-employed income, then it's likely that you could qualify for what's called an individual 401k or a solo 401k. So, assuming you have self-employed income, and remember, this is one of those areas where you want to learn to use the tax code to your advantage, because think of all the things that the government wants to tax you for that they consider self-employed income. You know, do you have some kind of a side hustle where you earn income? It could be as simple as you have garage sales or you have a booth at the farmer's market. It doesn't really matter what it is. The government wants to tax that income, and they treat it as self-employed earned income. And so generally, if you have self-employed earned income and you're engaged in whatever kind of enterprise that seeks to make a profit, and that could be something that's formally organized as a single member LLC or just simply doing business as, or maybe 1099 earned income. I mean, the real bottom line to being eligible to open an individual 401k is that you don't have employees. And so if that's a situation you're in, then potentially you could go to a discount broker. I personally use Charles Schwab, and you could open your own individual 401k. And again, you can have this in addition to your employer's 401k. The advantage to this is that you could take your IRA balance, roll it into your own personal individual 401k. That gives you the zero IRA balance. You're thus allowed to then participate in the backdoor Roth contributions. And the advantage to having the individual 401k at a discount broker is that you're not limited to the small selection of choices that most employers offer. Keep in mind that you can not only do a traditional 401k individual, but also an individual 401k Roth. And if you have a spouse and she's engaged in your business, then effectively she can have all those same benefits in her own individual accounts without creating a whole separate business entity. Bottom line here, if you have any type of earned income, you should seriously consider an individual 401k. Okay, now back to Stephen's original question. When you stop contributing to a standard IRA and just use a taxable brokerage account with high income earnings, well, Stephen, you become more financially resilient and your net worth is building, especially when you're relying on long-term capital gains, you'll find that the tax penalties aren't necessarily as bad as most people think they are. Now, don't get me wrong, I do think that taxation is theft, and I don't like paying taxes any more than anybody else. But bottom line, if you're looking at long-term capital gains, so that's holding an investment for at least 12 months, then you're going to be paying somewhere around 15 to 20%, which is considerably less in taxes than you're paying on your earned income. So think of it as a job. Are you not going to advance in your career or not going to build your business because every time you make more money, the government just takes more from you? I mean, you'd never get rich if that was your thought process. So apply that to your savings and your investing in your taxable accounts and have the philosophy that you know that the government's going to take their cut and it's better to have 80% of long-term gains than to have 100% of nothing. The paradigm on taxable accounts can even shift to where it's, in some cases, better to have money in a taxable long-term brokerage account than it is in an IRA or traditional 401k. Because remember, those tax advantage type investing vehicles, when you take the money out, it's always subject to ordinary income tax rates, which again are generally going to be much higher than the 15 to 20% you'll pay in long-term gains. And when you get to the point when you're thinking about keeping your gains for decades versus just years, then you might find yourself in a situation where when you die, your beneficiaries can potentially receive your long-term capital gains without having to pay taxes because they inherit them on the value of the day that you pass away. And that's in contrast to your beneficiary inheriting your IRA or your 401k, because all those assets are going to be taxed at an ordinary income rate instead of that potentially zero stepped up capital gains rate. In any case, Stephen, you're doing an excellent job of earning, saving, and investing. That's exactly the way I built my own personal wealth. That's the type of clients that I focus on at my investment firm, Investable Wealth. And those are the principles I talk about on the Wealth Standing Podcast. So as always, thanks for the questions. Until next time, this is John Pagliano.
Definitely not a terrible problem to have, is it? And I just want to say, if you don't listen to John Pugliano's Wealth Studying Podcast, you should. It only comes out a couple, it'll be 2 to 4 times a month that he'll have episodes. He takes deep dives into what's currently going on, and he is a fantastic investment manager as well. And you should definitely, whatever, however you subscribe to this podcast, subscribe to Wealth Studying Podcast. It's just, it's like getting a couple bonus segments, really, because his show's like 10 to 15 minutes long. All right, so with that, let's go ahead and get into my segment. I want to talk to you about the college enrollment cliff, and I also want to talk to you about the fact that we've lost 100 colleges net over the last 2 academic years. There's 100 less colleges in America. This was a listener sent me this article and said, yeah, Jack's right again. And I don't like reading articles. I don't like to read on air. I don't think it's I'm not good at it, I guess, as a narrator. I'm a great speaker, but not a great reader. It sounds like I'm reading. And so I thought it would be fun is I've never done this before. I'm going to have an AI assistant read the article to you, and then I'll come back and we'll talk about it. It's about 2.5 minutes long.
About 100 higher education institutions in the United States have closed between 2022-23 and 2023-24 academic years. According to a report published Wednesday by the National Center for Education Statistics, the U.S. Department of Education data shared with Inside Higher Ed show that a total of 73 higher education institutions closed, 17 merged, and 71 lost Title IV eligibility between 2022 and 2024. At the same time, during the 2023-24 academic year, 62 colleges and universities were added, according to the same report, resulting in a total net loss of 99 institutions, Erudera.com reports. The list below shows some of the institutions that announced closures recently. Cabrini University in Pennsylvania. Casanova College in New York. Holy Names University in California. Iowa Wesleyan University in Iowa. Philadelphia's University of the Arts in Pennsylvania. Presentation College in South Dakota. The King's College in New York. According to the report, fewer colleges and universities have qualified for financial aid programs, down from 5,918 in 2022-23 to 5,819 institutions in the 2023-24 academic year. Of these institutions, 2,691 are four-year institutions, 1,496 two-year institutions, and 1,632 were classified as less than two-year institutions. The reasons behind college closures include a decline in enrollment and the inability to recover from losses. Over the past year, 15 colleges shut down, of which 10 were affiliated with a religion. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, there are 3,982 degree-granting higher education institutions in the U.S. as of the 2019-20 academic year.
So just on full disclosure, I did cut a piece out of that about a particular religious college that closed its doors and what the board said, and I don't think you need that to get the gist of it, but there's a link to that article in the show notes today under link one next to my bullet point is what it'll say. And link two will go to an article over on vitaldesign.com, which is kind of a think tank for stuff like this. And I'll tell you, the universities pay attention to them, kind of like a major brand or like a major marketing firm, like major brands might pay attention. Even if they don't retain them, they pay attention to what they're saying, okay? They have an article about what colleges can do about this, and it's all marketing fluff bullshit. Stand for something, that's number one, is stand for something that students care about. Generate demand for your degree programs. How about develop degree programs that are in demand already instead of convincing people that a degree in gender studies will help? Focus and hone your degree programs. That sounds like a positive, proactive thing, but when you actually read it, it's really more about just get rid of the ones that aren't making money. It isn't really about making the ones you have any better than they are. Widen your recruitment base. Which is code for lower your admission standards and recruit students that otherwise wouldn't get into your school. Use content marketing to reach students earlier in the decision funnel. So start recruiting people in like eighth grade to your college, basically, because there's less people to recruit. Beat or leverage third-party aggregator sites. So this is a way of saying make sure you're listed everywhere where people would search for a school and a degree program. And reduce applicant friction. That's also code for lower your admission standards. Make it easier for a student to get into your school. None of this actually addresses the problem. So what is the problem? The problem is multifaceted. Number one, about the 1970s, we started on this moronic marketing campaign of telling every young person that they needed to go to college and basically convincing them that if they didn't, their life sucked. And we keep putting out these stupid statistics about the average degree person, what their income is, versus a person with no degree, and understanding that, you know, people with degrees generally don't end up, you know, doing things like, I don't know, sweeping the floor of a slaughterhouse or something like that. They just don't have the complete low end that drags down what otherwise intelligent and productive people who don't have degrees, the aggregate income is artificially lowered. By that. And it also ignores all of the people with degrees who aren't employed. They're only rating incomes of people who are employed, and many times people that are able to go to four-year universities for 6 years to get a degree are people from relatively wealthy families, or, you know, they marry into money or whatever, and they don't actually work. And so their zero doesn't drag down, but everybody that has a job that doesn't have a degree is all lumped into non-college educated. So it's a very skewed thing that's been used to sell young people on the idea that it does make sense to borrow $200,000 to get a job that will have a starting wage of $45,000. That somehow mathematically makes sense. And part of it is due to this huge desire by the institutions of this country to control the minds of the youth. And they know that college-educated kids are actually college program kids, and they sway way to the left. You ever notice that we have this constant drumbeat by the left about how America is institutionally racist? Have you ever thought about who controls all the institutions in the country? The bureaucratic institutions are controlled by the left. The university system is controlled by the left. The major tech platforms are controlled by the left, and the media is controlled by the left. That's every big pharmaceutical and big food are controlled by the left. every major institution in this country is controlled by the left, but the left says we're institutionally racist. That's interesting. And it's this kind of weird, doesn't make any sense concept. It's this blinded people to anything, you know, approaching common sense, logic, and reason. So they have overfueled this because they see it as their way to control the population. Nobody votes more reliably left than a college-educated white woman. I'm telling you, you can look at it flat out across all the minorities and et cetera. A college-educated white woman is almost a guaranteed solid voter for the left. And there's a huge swing in men that come out of the university system versus men that don't, though it's not as dramatic as it is for females. And so because they've seen this as their golden calf, they've super promoted it, and they've made all this money available, and the colleges went crazy with the money. And the colleges said, hey, if we need a new building, we'll just raise tuition prices, since they borrow the money anyway. Basically, you're going to borrow money to go to school, and you're not even going to think about paying it back for at least 4, maybe 6, maybe 8 years. And it's very easy to sell somebody when they can just fill out some forms and get money, and when they're young enough to not really think about having to pay it back. Well, all those chickens are coming home to roost. Because now there's a surplus of degrees, and when you have a surplus of something, its value declines. So you have all these people that are graduating with degrees, and they think they're entitled to jobs making $100,000 a year, and a starting job in their profession, you know, is somewhere between $30,000 and $50,000. And so they don't want that job. Well, you're not getting... So then they go do something else, or they don't get a job, and these other young people who have siblings, and they're watching this happen, and they're listening to their siblings say, I'll never pay my loans off, I'll never own a house. They're like, well, then why would I do this? So the part of the enrollment cliff that we're seeing up to this point, because the cliff hasn't hit yet, it's going to hit this coming academic cycle. Understand this. We had 200 colleges close their doors. Or, I'm sorry, 100 colleges close their doors. 99 net loss out of the whole university system in 2 years. That's a big deal. And we haven't had this cliff yet. That's the big thing. It hasn't hit. The cliff itself is, in the 2000s, people started having dramatically less children per couple, and less people got married and had children at all. There's simply less children coming out of high school. Now, if you say every single child that comes out of high school is a candidate for college, and that number drops, then the number of kids going to college goes down kind of logarithmically with it, because we played the game of lowering admission standards as long as we can, and the people that can't get in now are really not capable at all. At all. I mean, at all. And so, basically, everybody that wanted to and had any ability to, like, read at, like, the 10th grade level when they graduated 12th grade got into school. I don't even know if you had to read at the 10th grade level, to be honest with you. And still don't. But now there's just less coming, there's less inventory coming through the pipeline. And all of this mass immigration is not helping them at all. They're not going to gain any students from this. Most of these people coming in are, you know, the majority of immigrants coming in right now, whether you like this or not, are in their 20s to 30s and they're men. And they're not going to go to college. They're just not. They're not the kind of people that are going to go to college. So we're looking at a number of graduate dropping from high school over the next couple of years by 15%. 15% less inventory in the funnel to get you into my university, there's 15% less prospects. Then you have all of the decline that we've experienced up to this point is fatigue of the marketing. It's the students refusing to go. I'm not doing it. I'm going to do something else. And we also have an explosion in other trades, like, you know, programming and coding and artificial intelligence, and there's all types of things that people can legitimately learn how to do and become really proficient at in about a year without all the bullshit that college stacks on top of it. You know, French literature and the plight of every marginalized group there is except the individual, and Marxist bullshit and all of that stuff is not necessary to learn how to work with a coding language. And the company hiring you to work with that coding language, they don't give a shit about how much Marxist philosophy you've absorbed. If they're a Marxist company, they're going to stick it in you anyway, and if they're not, they don't want it. So you have this catastrophe unfolding here, and this is the part that people do not get. Its impact across the country on a macroeconomic level is going to be huge, and it's already hitting. Many of these colleges that are closing, you know, had previously had, you know, student bodies, a small college, 1,000 across, you know, 4 years. Some of these larger colleges that are beginning to merge in some of their towns, you know, they're talking thousands of students. And every 2 or 4 years, depending on the type of institution, a whole new batch of students, many who are not from the area, right? And when I say not from the area, they might even be from the state or somewhere nearby, but they didn't live in that town. They moved to that town to go to that school. And restaurants, bars, rental properties for housing. There's this entire ecosystem of economics that revolves around that institution. And a lot of these places, if you go and you look at some of these smaller colleges, that college is the only thing of any significant size in that place. There's no major manufacturing. There's no major construction company. Maybe there's no real major agricultural concern. There's nothing there that's bigger than that institution. And so now it closes. So now all the students who were bringing all the money from their parents that were all proud of them for going to school don't come. So the bars and the restaurants and all, they have to like lay people off, close down, etc. Some of them survive, some of them don't. But who else is part of this? All those professors and teachers and administrative staff. That school might employ 200 people. Now, 200 jobs lost doesn't sound like a big deal. But in a town with, let's say, 10,000 people, and 5,000 people have jobs in that town, and 200 people lose their jobs en masse, they just go away, and those people mostly leave, or worse, they stay and compete for the remaining jobs. Now, how many businesses were serving those 200 jobs plus that 1,000 students? That's 1,200 people gone. So then they go, and it's like pulling on a thread, and then the whole towel turns into nothing but a bunch of threads. You're going to see small towns all over this country literally disappear. And they're trying things to resurrect them, right? To bring life to the dead. Change them into office complexes and business percolators. But there's not enough going on for that to really work. And it's not that, like, the reason there's not more businesses, there's not more buildings for businesses to be inside of. I believe that could be pulled off, but I don't think anybody's really done it yet. And I think that we need to understand that this problem is going into major cascade. At a time when, like, let's say the economy was robust and growing and real GDP, not the bullshit GDP, like they dig basically, if they dig dirt out of one hole and put it in another, they say that's part of the value of the GDP now. They literally say that if this year a company, like let's say a big university that pays pensions to its teachers, says we now estimate that our payout in the year 2035 is going to be X, they put that down as this year's GDP to the pensions because that's when it was calculated. That's the game they're playing. So the GDP sucks. The growth in GDP sucks. But if it was real GDP, we're in negative GDP growth for years now, consecutively. We are in a recession. When you add a cascading event like this that's going to be like little bombs going off all over the country to an already distressed and in decline economy, where do you think we're headed? And on top of this, how many people that are products of that system literally don't know how to do anything? And I don't just mean, we'll get to the staff, and I'm talking about students that are graduates. How many people have come out of the university system and they can't actually do anything? They really can't. They're no more skilled. In fact, the guy that grew up on a farm and went out and got a job working at, you know, a tractor factory or something like that at 19 years of age and has worked his way up there and has moved into management is probably way more, at 27, is way more qualified than a college graduate at 27 who spent 2 years schlepping coffee for somebody and still didn't know anything. So you have this entire, like, the movers and shakers, if you want to think about it, the Gen Zs and young millennials are largely unskilled for an economy in flux. Guys, we're fucked. That's what I'm telling you. This thing about the schools is, like, I know I bring it up a lot. It's not like my pet issue, like me cheering on the demise of the university system, though a lot of it should die. It's a canary in the coal mine. It's showing you our future. And it's showing it to you very clearly if you have only the eyes to see and the ears to hear. The entire mechanism by which the United States economy has been functioning on for the last 30 years has largely been bullshit. I would say 30% of jobs in what we would call corporate America are wholly unnecessary. And when we get to a stress point, then corporations will acknowledge that and begin throwing these people out, and they don't have anything they know how to do. And how old are they when it happens to them will have a lot to do with whether they can adapt. A 27-year-old, if they want to, can learn to work on a car or learn how to build a cabinet or work in construction, or because there's a ton of stuff that needs to be fixed, right? There are certain skills that are not going to be automated out anytime soon. There's a whole shitload of these people. They don't have anything to do. And all these teachers that are losing their jobs at these colleges, and by the way, this is happening in high school now, and middle school now, and grade school now. One of the wealthiest school districts in the Dallas-Fort Worth area is Plano Independent School District, north of Dallas, up toward Frisco, Addison, up that area. They're closing six freaking schools next year. And this is further down the pike in the cliff. It's not high schools they're closing. They're closing elementary schools. So if you're closing elementary schools this year, you're closing middle schools in 2 to 3 years, and you're closing high schools 4 to 5 years out. And you're closing high schools, now you're cascading it. You see how this all goes together. Now, this is a growth area for decades in North Texas. This is a place where they have not had a big population drop in adults. This isn't Plano is a very affluent area. It is still one of the wealthiest districts in the whole area. They're just not having kids. Mom and dad aren't leaving. Mom and dad are having no kids or one kid. We have a rise of a thing called dinks. Because when economies suck, people have less children because children are expensive. You know what dink is? Double income, no kids. This is a thing, like on TikTok, bragging about how many snacks they can fucking eat because they have no children. So there's, on top of all the mess that you can understand why people would have less children, we also have this kind of selfish, me-centered economy, me-centered society. And when these children go to college to be educated, that is reinforced in so many ways. If you have children, you're hurting the planet. We have global warming. We're all going to die. So there's that. Then the economy does suck. Right, but then there's also this pandering need that these institutions who are trying to survive by doing this, and they're killing themselves anyway, whatever that young person needs to hear about themselves to feel good about themselves, tell them that. Unless it is they're proud to be strong and independent. Anything other than that, I believe that I'm a tree. Okay, you're a tree. I believe I'm a cat. Here's a litter box. I believe a man can become a woman and go back to a man again if they want to. Okay, sure. Men can breastfeed and have babies. Sure, right? Like, when you tell people whatever they want to hear, they become, that's where the entitlement comes from. Now, it's me. So, when you think that way and you're 28 years old, you realize if I have a baby, it's going to actually negatively impact the next 10 years of my life. Especially if I have 2 or 3, because we need like 2.6 to maintain population. So they're very centered on that, and they're in a state of mind because of all this programming from the schools and society as a whole that they can't understand that, yes, you will make sacrifices when you have children. But how many women do we now have that are in their late 30s, early 40s, realizing they're never going to have kids and now deeply regretting it? This is all a mess that is very difficult to fully understand. But it all revolves around this collapse in the education system. And again, I am not trying to save the education system because I think it does a good job. I'm telling you that as this dies, there is a transition period to building something that educates that next evolution in humanity that looks totally different. And like everything else in this period of flux, there is a huge potential to get ground up in it. This is not a time to rest easy unless you've really been a good aunt and you're really set. This is a time to be building and looking for opportunity. We're going to have to completely rebuild this country when this shit's all over with. No matter who wins the election, no matter what the next 5 years looks like, I know what the next 20 looks like. And for people like me, you know, that means you're talking about being in the peak of this shit when we're in our 70s. Some of you guys are older than me in your 80s, you know. Not necessarily the best time to deal with flux when you're old. Not really, you know. And then the young people at the same time, what have we taught them? What do they not know? They can't drive a stick shift. They can't write cursive. Not that I think those two things are really that important, but, like, it's pretty basic. It's more that those are analogies for all the things that they don't know and all the things that they don't understand, all the things they've never been exposed to. And we've created an entire, two generations. Like, maybe three. Literally, like, the youngest Gen Xers all the way down to the Zoomers. So going across three generations of people who literally believe they should never be uncomfortable. They should never be uncomfortable. That is not a group of people ready for what they're about to run into. And don't, if you're like, I'm ready, and don't be too sanctimonious about it, because if you think just because you're going to do better that you're immune from the impact of this, blatantly, you're just wrong. Anyway, with that, the good news is these types of fluctuations always also create immense opportunity for those willing to capitalize on them. So be thinking about what you can do to be part of the rebuilding of society, because we are going to rebuild society. And when I say that, I know there's people that are going to be like, oh, well, what he's saying is like cities burned to the ground and shit. Maybe in some places. That's not what I mean. We had to rebuild society after World War II. We had to rebuild society after the Civil War, even though a lot of the cities weren't burned to the ground. We had to rebuild society every time in history of the world there's been a major flux change. And hopefully we can do that this time without also invoking, you know, global freaking war into all of it, because all bets are off then. Anyway, with that, I want to leave you with a little bit more of an upswing, since you are not going to hear from me again in new shows until Tuesday, and I'm going to be gone so much of next week. Again, do not be discouraged by this. Just take it seriously and understand you're in the mess already. You're already here. The beauty of it is, where there are problems, there are opportunities. Where there are problems, there's always jobs. And we have plenty of problems, and that equals plenty of opportunity. With that, I'll wrap up today. Thank you for tuning in, and I will catch you tomorrow with a flashback, Monday with a rewind, and Tuesday live with John and Nicole.
Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.